Thank you very much. Now, topic of today's talk is motivated by the recent experimental progress
in loading multiple species of atoms into one single apparatus and being able to manipulate them separately. So in particular, having potentials which allow to move and manipulate just one species of the atoms without doing anything to the other species. But these types of mixtures of degenerate gases have been studied quite a lot recently. They have quite complicated phase diagrams and are not fully understood yet. However, the topic of my talk will not be so much about that, so I will not try to establish a phase diagram or do anything similar to that, but rather stay in a regime where we pretty well understand what the physics is, and where everything, or more or less everything, can be understood, and instead try to show that these types of systems have the potential to do some quite nice measurements and measure properties of degenerate gases, and that it is also a useful tool if one wants to engineer certain Hamiltonians, engineer certain states, do some cooling and loading and things like that. And if there is some time left, I will later talk about our ideas on how to create magnetic fields in optical lattices, so how to simulate an artificial magnetic field. But first I will talk about immersed optical lattices, and this will be mainly about these two papers that I've listed here. The situation that I consider will be simplified to the most general situation everyone has. So what I will consider is species A, atoms A, which are trapped in an optical lattice. So they see the optical lattice and are trapped in this periodic potential. And then a second species, B, which does not see that optical lattice and can be either a fermionic or bosonic background gas. There will be interactions between these two species, A and B, and these will cause some phonons. And the assumption, and the main simplifying assumption that I will make, is that this background gas here is a lot bigger than the system, so than the atoms in the optical lattice, such that this background acts more or less like a bath. So what we have here is we have a bath of atoms which can absorb some energy, so there can be some dissipation of energy by creating phonons. And the interaction between this bath and the lattice atoms will lead to some modifications of the dynamics in the optical lattice and on the properties of the atoms in this optical lattice, and that's what I will focus on. Now, before I start on that, I want to talk just a little bit about how to create these different optical potentials for different species. Now, if we take an atom with two internal states, 0 and 1, here, and subject these to a laser, then what we get is an AC Stark shift, which will be different depending on whether the laser is red or blue detuned. If the laser is red detuned, the AC Stark shift will be negative, so there will be a negative parameter alpha in front of the laser intensity and create a potential which attracts the atoms to the regions of high laser intensity. If the laser is blue detuned, what we get is a positive alpha, and therefore the atoms will be attracted to the regions of low intensity. And if one now wants to create a state-dependent potential, then this can be done by either using two different species of atoms, where one simply doesn't see the laser and so is transparent to this laser, or if we look at alkali atoms, there's some magic frequencies where this happens. So consider the fine structure here, and the two ground states are the MS plus 1/2 and MS minus 1/2 state. If we now apply sigma plus and sigma minus polarized light, then this MS plus 1/2 state will see some AC Stark shift due to the presence of this B3 half state here, and will be red detuned in this example. And the MS minus 1/2 state here will have some red detuning with respect to this P3 half state and some blue detuning with respect to the other P1 half state here. And so the shifts of those two, the AC Stark shifts due to these two states here, will have opposite signs, and by choosing the right frequency, we can achieve that the AC Stark shifts on this MS minus 1/2 state due to the B3 half and the B1 half state exactly cancel. So there will be some shift by this state and some shift by that state, and they will exactly cancel out to zero. And if one draws the AC Stark shift as a function of the detuning, we can exactly see this. This is the detuning due to the sigma plus laser light of the MS minus 1/2 state and MS plus 1/2 state. The MS minus 1/2 state will always be red detuned here and only blue detuned up there, and so there will always be an attraction to the regions of largest intensity. Whereas the MS minus 1/2 state will see some red detuning here with respect to both states. In between the P1/2 and P3/2 states, there will be red and blue detuning, and at some frequency here, we'll get a zero shift and these two cancel, and therefore the MS minus 1/2 state will be transparent to the sigma plus laser light and not see it. And we can do the same thing for the sigma minus light, and therefore we can achieve the situation where this MS plus 1/2 state is manipulated and trapped only by sigma plus laser light, and this red state similarly only by sigma minus laser light. And so by moving the sigma plus and sigma minus lasers independently, we can take the wave function of an atom, which can be a superposition of those two states, and separate them in space and move them back again. And so that's one of the techniques that can be used to create state-dependent potentials. Now, we've been considering...
This is the potential, the overall potential, or this is the lattice potential?
This can be
anything.
I mean, it can be just an overall potential in a far off resonance trap, maybe. It can be, most often it will be an optical lattice, in particular in my case. But that's not really significant. The important thing is that you have the right detunings. Then it will happen for any type of laser.
In practice, is it like your exotic implementation, or is it pretty standard?
No, it has been done in the lab. So this has been done. It has been done in the group by Emmanuel Bloch, and he has used that to do these controlled collisions between atoms. So they've exactly implemented that, and it works pretty well. They can shift the atoms for a few microns without getting any decoherence in that way. So this is, I mean, it's not standard, not everybody can do it, but there are labs where this can be done. It was systematically done, but as far as I know, in that all the experiments that studied this were in one group, in the group by Emmanuel Bloch in Mainz, Munich. So he has studied that in detail. I don't think it's really common to many labs yet. Yes, there might be several people who want to do it or have already started to do that. Yeah, that's true.
And that spin dependent on collisions for bosons.
Well, that's for bosons in this case where I consider sodium or rubidium, but in principle the same technique works for all alkali-like atoms. So. Well, the experiments that were done for rubidium. So, in principle, you could imagine doing this with potassium 39 or something like that. It would work as well. Okay, so that's the basic technique, or one of the possibilities to create this kind of state-dependent lattices, where one can move and manipulate different atoms in or different species of atoms differently. And we have studied several of these configurations now where something like this is done. And the first thing we studied was looking at a reservoir which is fermionic and an optical lattice. And this fermionic reservoir is used to fill the lattice via some Raman transition. Now, I'm not going to explain this in detail. I just want to mention the basic principle how this is done. So what we assumed here was that a Raman laser takes particles out of this reservoir and puts them into the first band of the optical lattice. Then the interaction between the atoms in this optical lattice and in the background will lead to the emission of a phonon, or of a particle-like phonon in this case, from the reservoir. So a particle will be ejected from this background, and at the same time, the particle in the upper band will go down into the lower band. Now, if these are fermions, then this process here is only allowed if the lower band is not filled yet, and therefore only that process will only happen if there's nothing there already. And this process here will be forbidden. And if one does this, often enough, one can ensure that all the lattice sites will be filled, so we can achieve a full filling of this lower band here, and we'll end up with some particles in the upper lattice, in the upper band, which can then be removed by another laser pulse, just be blown away.
So you're flipping the magnifying spinner sort of thing, so it goes from a state where it doesn't see the lattice.
Exactly. Yes. Yes. That's the assumption behind it. Now, we have analyzed this in detail and shown that in that way one can achieve quite high filling factors, where the probability of having an empty lattice site is nearly zero, so can be 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4, and the application of that would be to use this lattice then as a quantum register where one has one qubit in each lattice site. So I'm not going to talk about that in more detail. I'm also not going to talk about the next bit in detail, since Peter Zoller, when he was here, talked about that in some detail. But I want to briefly mention that we've looked at the situation where the background gas now is a Bose condensate, and the atoms in the lattice are fermions. And what we want to achieve is we want to cool these atoms, we want to cool these fermionic atoms in the lattice to temperatures which are much less than the height of the lower band. Now this corresponds to a few picokelvin or even less. And the way to achieve this is similar to what is done in laser cooling, but with the difference here that the laser cooling works with photons, and we replace these photons by phonons in this BEC. The advantage of that is that these phonons are much better adapted to the energies that we have in this optical lattice, so we'll have energies that are much smaller than photon energies, therefore recoil energies and stuff and heating that happens in standard laser cooling does not affect the scheme. And in principle, how this works is that we take again a Raman laser, which now takes a boson fermion from the lower band into the upper band, and then again have interactions between the optical lattice atoms and the background atoms, emitting a phonon into the BEC and going back down. Now, one can tune or one can adjust this laser such that it predominantly takes atoms with large quasi-momentum in the lower band and excites those atoms to the upper band. Whereas atoms which are close to a quasi-momentum zero will not be affected, so they will stay in the lower band. The emission, the spontaneous emission of the phonons is not selective, so these atoms which are put up there will go back down with equal probability in all quasi-momentum states, and therefore there is some probability that they will go down to a state near quasi-momentum zero, and if that happens, then the atoms will remain there. So they will be basically transparent to this laser. These will be dark atoms which don't see the laser and are not excited back up again. So if one now takes sufficiently many of these laser pulses exciting only atoms from high quasi-momentum states, what one can achieve is that the particles accumulate in this state near quasi-momentum zero, and so for non-interacting bosons in this optical lattice, they would all accumulate here and form the ground state. And we've also done this for fermions, where instead of getting a peak here, one can arrange the laser such that there is a whole region in this optical lattice which is transparent, and therefore what we get is an almost perfect Fermi distribution in there, particular temperatures which are a tenth or even less of this height of the bandwidth in the optical lattice. Now those are two things that one can do. So we can cool the atoms, we can load them by using these background gases. And what I want to talk about mostly today is how such a background gas would affect the motion of the atoms that just move in the lowest band. Now, what do we expect to happen? Well, what we expect to happen is that the presence of an atom in...
Sorry, can I just ask you a question about the previous picture?
Yes.
So, the idea is somehow the laser you're using to excite the atoms to the higher band is somehow detuned from the zone center, so the atoms there have nowhere to go.
Yes, you can see it like that. I mean, it's not just the detuning, it's also the pulse duration.
Uh-huh.
And the pulse duration and the detuning need to match exactly in such a, can be adjusted exactly in such a way that any atom in there will not see the laser. So if you, yes?
Okay, so there's not one of these things like EIT where you have...
No, it's just not.
There's only one laser here.
No, no, there's one laser, one Raman laser here, and no, there's nothing to do with EIT. It is a dark state which does not see these specific pulses. If the pulse duration or the pulse intensity were different, but the same frequency, it would not work. Okay, so there's a specific sequence of pulses that one needs to apply in order to achieve that. But that can be worked out. And is, I mean, the sequence of pulses, that's the nice thing. We didn't have to work that out because that is known more or less from laser cooling and works quite well there. Okay, so there are several effects that one expects now from this background gas if the atoms are finally loaded into this lowest band. One of the effects is that the presence of an atom in the lattice will deform the BEC. So what we'll get is a little dip in this BEC, and when the atom moves around in the optical lattice, it needs to carry this dip with it. And that's what I refer to as a polaron. So the atom in the lattice and the dip in the BEC moving together through the lattice, that would be a polaron in there.
About dip in the density of
BEC? It's a dip in the density of the BEC, yes. At the same time, this dip in the density will have a size that is approximately the healing length, and this healing length can exceed the distance between adjacent atoms in the lattice, and therefore this dip will affect nearby atoms. So what we'll get is some potential here which attracts nearby atoms, and therefore the standard kind of Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian describing the atoms in the lowest band will be modified with some offset interaction. So we'll get an extended Hubbard model where there is some additional interaction. Now, the...
Sorry, just ask a couple of questions. So this relies, does it, on the effect of mass in the particles and lattice being much higher than the
nice
and
things
in the condensate because of
what the yeah, it relies on the fact that what we well I will put up the condition exactly.
It sounds a bit quasi static that the condensate is responding almost to a static preservation, and then you're looking at the kind of overlap of that as it pops around or something. Is that right? So it's
Well, that's not what we assume. I mean, I will do the calculation and tell you exactly what the assumptions are to get that picture, but I first want to state what effects we expect and then work them out.
Hamiltonian doesn't incorporate any assumptions here.
No, this Hamiltonian doesn't. No, I will make the assumptions now.
It could be a repulsive interaction with the dark or attractive
ones. It doesn't matter. So it will always be attractive to nearby atoms. Okay, so we have this type of dip, we have the interaction. At the same time, what will happen is that we'll see that the fact that these atoms need to carry along this dip will cause the coherent hopping to go down. So they will have a reduced hopping amplitude and not move with the same hopping rate as they do if the background gas were not there. And this will be changed or modified hopping rate J A tilde. And finally, if the temperature of the background BEC is large enough, then there can be some thermally activated hopping. So instead of hopping due to the kinetic energy and coherently hopping through the lattice, what we'll find is that there is some thermally activated hopping at sufficiently large temperatures. And these are the effects that I would like to explain. Now, we start out with a Hamiltonian that is pretty standard. So this is the Barth Hamiltonian. That's just the Bose condensate in the background with some external trapping potential, which we will more or less disregard. And then we have some interaction between the atoms in the Bose condensate and in the lattice. And this is just a standard density-density interaction. Now, I want to mention something here first. And this is that while in the previous cases where we had atoms move from the upper band to the lower band, there was some dissipation of energy, so the particles that were ejected into the background would carry away some energy. This will not happen here, simply because the phonon energy is linear in these, well, small energy ranges, and the slope determined by the speed of sound will be a lot larger in general than the band structure here. And so we simply don't have energy momentum conservation in transitions which would change the energy here. So all that we expect to get is really some phase fluctuations and changes in the phase due to the presence of this background, but not really dissipation of energy at low temperatures, at least. Now, I want to start out very simple, and before going into the case where we expose a full total optical lattice to the BEC, just look at what happens if we take just a single atom or a bunch of atoms which don't interact with each other and work out what happens in that case. Now, a deep lattice can realize an atomic quantum dot that was, for instance, shown in this paper here by Alessandro Riccati and others in 2005. And we will assume such a quantum dot, so just a single atom or many single atoms which don't interact with each other, being dunked into this BEC, and the BEC can be 1D, 2D, or 3D. And in order for there not to be any interaction, we assume, first of all, the lattice to be deep, no hopping, and that the distance between the atoms is a lot larger than the Heeling length. That will change later. And so what I get is that, or what we do is, we expand the density, condensate density operator, just the standard form as some mean field density, plus some fluctuations, and assume the quantum dot to be a Gaussian, so being trapped in a harmonic oscillator potential, and then rewrite this Bach-Hamiltonian in terms of a phase and the density. So this is the phase and density conjugate variables. And then... The impurity is localized. So the assumption is that this impurity is trapped, for instance, in a harmonic trap of a lattice site, and this will cause it to be localized to 20, 30, 50 nanometers or something like that. So quite well localized. Now, if you work out what happens to the temporal correlation function of the impurity, we find that this is given by this expectation value here, where we have the spatial wave function of the impurity integrated over this phase variable here only. So what we see is that this expectation value, this correlation function, will be determined by phase fluctuations in the condensate if the impurity is not moved through the condensate. This integral here will always be centered at the same position, and since the impurity is very well localized, this is something like a coarse-grained phase fluctuation measure. So what we get here is the phase fluctuations integrated over with a small Gaussian function, and therefore we can measure in that way, by measuring these correlation functions here, we can measure directly the phase fluctuations if the impurity is static. If the impurity is moved around, and this can be moved around by just using these different lasers, for instance, that I talked about before, then what we can achieve is that this integral here will integrate always over different positions and therefore measure the phase as a function of position as well as a function of time. Now...
Something that's a bit confusing. This is the correlation from the chi operators of the impurity.
Yes. Chi.
And the spacing of the levels in the quantum dot is the biggest energy.
Yes. So there is no excitation to higher levels.
So somehow it's just stuck in the ground state.
Yes.
Well, I think it's very inert.
It is, yes. That's. Yeah, I will show now. Okay, that's why I say here a Ramsey interferometry, and I will explain how this Ramsey interferometry works. And that's what I want to do next, because, of course, I mean, in principle, you have to just measure this correlation function, but how do you do this if the atom is stuck in one spatial mode? And I will talk about that next, or in two slides, actually. So this is what this correlation function is. So it is a direct measure of the phase operator in this Bose condensate. And for just the Bose condensate in thermal equilibrium, we can work out exactly what this gives. And the nice thing about this is that the Hamiltonian maps onto an independent boson model, so it's very easy to solve that. And we can exactly solve this. And what you see here is that these linear terms in BK and BK dagger, which are the Bogoliubov excitations, by diagonalizing this Hamiltonian, we have to simply shift the harmonic oscillators. So what happens is that the presence of this atom in the BEC shifts the harmonic oscillators describing the Bogoliubov excitations, but does not affect their frequency. And that means that the presence of this impurity atom will not change the fluctuations, and therefore the measure that we get, or these measurements that we do, really is a measure of the true fluctuation that we have. Which
you say where was coming from, this error guy? I mean, normally it's a little, you think that you have a phase variable and everything should be 2-pi periodic in it, and that doesn't look like it is.
This is the main assumption that we make. So we have the BEC having some mean field density plus some fluctuations, and the phase variable is to conjugate to this n hat here. Now the impurity is very simple, a single mode system. So this chi dagger chi counts the number of particles in the single impurity mode. So it counts the number of particles sitting in this quantum dot, and that number will always be 1. So the only thing that we can get there is a global phase, which in principle you think would not be measurable. Okay, but I will show now how to measure that.
It's essentially something like the X-ray edge problem. X-ray edge problem.
I don't know about that. But.
He hasn't done anything sudden yet.
When he measured this quantum, chi is the creation operator.
Yes.
For the impurity. Right?
Yes. Exactly. I mean, that's maybe what I should have said. So what happens here is that what we assume here is that this impurity is created at time zero and destroyed at a later time tau. And the way that this will be created and destroyed is by taking an atom, splitting its wave function via these state-dependent potentials that I talked about, and move one bit into the BEC. That's at time zero when this impurity is created. Then wait for some time and move it back, and then destroy it again. Okay, and that's how this correlation function here comes in. Maybe I'm not explaining this too well.
The idea is okay. It's
I mean, this comes out, I mean, by writing down this Hamiltonian, or more easily this one here in just the Bogoliubov description, one can work out this correlation function exactly. So there is no approximation going into that.
Why is it not?
Well, these are just the fluctuations that I'm going to measure. So what will happen is that this correlation function will drop off. It will be.
That's an operator in there, right?
Yes.
A to the minus. Define module 2 pi. Doing everything.
But if I change the phase here by 2 pi and there by 2 pi. Then that will cancel.
The claim is that if the phase of the condensate winds by 2 pi during the time you measure that correlation,
yes.
Then that has a physical effect. Okay. So conservation has to be
maybe. Okay, so.
Can I just ask one question on the last equation?
Yes.
Did you say that? That you're assuming the spectrum of Bogoliubov modes isn't changed by the presence or absence of the impurity?
Yes, that's what you get from here. But the solution will just, I mean, the presence of this impurity will just shift the harmonic oscillators, but it will not change their frequencies.
I mean, you can imagine that you create a band state of the Bogoliubov modes.
well, that's not happening.
I mean, say, for example, the impurities are thoughts of potential, so it diminishes the density of the thought state.
Yes.
Mirror itself, thinking kind of crudely, things all the same, drops in that vicinity, and hence the phonons are softer.
But that would be beyond the validity of this this model here. So as long as these impurities will not change the density dramatically, so we assume that the density does not drop down to zero when the presence of a single atom, a single impurity, will change it slightly, but not dramatically. It's just one atom.
If the situation arises, one can incorporate that.
Well, one would have to, yeah.
The permeance, when there's a thousand of the things, you have to know that.
So, okay.
Yeah, it's just the same ones that didn't happen. So.
No, if one can describe the condensate in terms of Kospiderski equation plus Bobrilubov excitations. As soon as the density is changed by too much and higher order terms come important, then not. Now, we can obtain this correlation function here for 1D, 2D, and 3D condensate. And what we find is that for 1D condensate, this correlation function drops off exponentially. So basically, the quantum dot will deface, and the defacing will be exponential. In the case of a 2D condensate, this defacing will be like a power law, with sigma over Ct, where C is the speed of sound and sigma is the width of the impurity wave function. And in the 3D condensate, we'll not get complete defacing, but we will get some value of this correlation function that depends on the temperature, the width, the density, and the ratio of the two interactions, and otherwise will be constant at large times. So if we wait for long enough, there will not be any further defacing, and this correlation function will remain constant. Now, this can be used by measuring this correlation function, and I still haven't said how to do this. For a standard BEC, for instance, one can measure the temperature, one can measure, if one wishes, these interaction strengths here, or the speed of sound and whatever properties appear in here. The question is now, how do we measure that? Well, how to measure this works by atom interferometry, and there is a recent review article which describes all this atom interferometry in some detail by Cronin, Schmidmeier, and Pritchard, which will be published soon, so it's not published yet. But this atom interferometry, you can basically think of that in the same way as standard interferometry, just with the roles of lights and atoms exchanged. So in atom interferometry, the atoms are used to create an interference pattern, and light is used to split up the wave functions of the atoms. And that technique is not very old. It has been established in the last 10, 15 years. But it is a very accurate method and is nowadays used for precision measurements of rotations, precision measurements of the gravitational constant, and other stuff. So this is a pretty accurate method to get measurements done. Now, how does this work in principle and in a very specific case that is well suited for measuring this correlation function chi of tau and chi of zero? What is done is that the wave function of an atom is first split up into two parts by applying a pi over two pi's. So the internal state A is turned into a superposition of internal states A and C. And then we use a state-dependent potential, one that I described before, to move this state C with respect to the state A. So phi of x times A remains constant, whereas the part of the wave function which is proportional to C will change with time. And that corresponds to, in this picture here, taking this particle's wave function, splitting it up into two, and then moving one part into the condensate, let's say. By moving it into the condensate, this one arm only, what we get is a phase that corresponds to this phase that I shown before, and is usually just a global phase. But here, in this case, of course, this global phase turns into a relative phase and therefore can be measured. The way that this is measured is by now taking this wave function here in this spin-dependent potential and moving it back to the old position, so both parts of the wave function are in the same place again, and then applying another pi over 2 pi, and that second pi over 2 pi turns this phase into a population. Now there is a population of the state A then, which is proportional to the cos squared of this phase, and there's a population in the state C, which is given by the sine squared of this phase. Now in that process, when moving one atom with respect to the other, one might acquire a kinetic phase surface that is just due to the motion of the atom, and that kinetic phase can be measured or calculated, and that's what I have here as a phase beta. It doesn't matter in the end, because if alpha changes by changing the BC properties, this will just fix where the zero of PA or PC would be. And in that way, one measures directly the correlation function that I've written down before by measuring this phase. And by looking at interference fringes that occur when changing, for instance, the time at which one part of the wave function is left in a condensate, we can now measure how these phase fluctuations look like. And I've plotted that here. How would that look like when one measures the BEC properties? Well, this is this correlation function in a 3D condensate. It would drop down and then just remain constant. In a 2D condensate, it would drop down like this power law potential, like this power law. And in 1D, we just get an exponential decay. And that's exactly what one would measure. So this phase is turned into a decaying visibility of these fringes, or they will just disappear over time. And similarly, one can measure that as a function of the temperature for different widths of the quantum dot and see how this fringe visibility after a certain time goes down with increasing temperature of the BEC.
Does that correspond to the phonons having linear dispersion, or does it correspond to?
No, the phonons here are assumed to all have linear dispersion, because, as I said before, the phonon branch is linear at small energies and turns into quadratic at so high energies that we don't ever consider temperatures of the BEC or interactions at such high energies. So we assumed here all of that to be linear. Now, let's go to the case where I have an immersed optical lattice now. So we change the situation, and instead of taking a single atom and dunking that into the BEC, we now take a whole lattice. And I'm not going to specify this H chi right now, but it will be just the Bose-Hubbard Hamiltonian. But simply assume that now we can write down this chi of R, so this destruction operator, as a sum over a discrete number of lattice sites where these eta nus are localized wave functions corresponding to the lattice sites, and the A nus are the corresponding destruction operator. Now, since we want to describe the dynamics of the atoms in that lattice, we cannot solve the Gross-Peterjewski equation at a finite interaction strength between optical lattice atoms and BEC, because we don't know what the configuration is, we don't know where the dips are. So what we do instead is we solve the Gross-Peterjewski equation at kappa equals zero, so assuming no interaction, and then continue by assuming that we have sufficiently weak BEC impurity coupling. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, by that I mean that this kappa divided by G, so this is the interaction strength between atoms in the lattice and BEC atoms, and G is the interaction strength in the lattice, divided by this N0 of R, that's the density of particles in the BEC, times the Heeling length to the power of D, that this is much smaller than 1. So if one assumes that kappa and G are on the same order of magnitude, they are both determined by scattering length, then this assumption simply means that within the Heeling length, volume of the Heeling length, we assume to have a sufficiently large number of particles, let's say 100 or more, and this is usually fulfilled in a standard BEC. And under this assumption, we may assume that the deviations in the delta phi, so in the density or in the amplitude of the BEC operator, are on the order kappa. And that's exactly going back to before. We don't assume that the presence of an atom in the lattice completely diminishes the density in the BEC. So this will be small deviations only. Now, since we've solved the GPE at kappa equals zero, unfortunately, the linear term in delta phi in the deviation from the bosonic field operator phi does not vanish. So what we get is some linear contribution where we have this chi dagger chi, some phi zero, that's the square root of the condensate density, and then some linear term in there, a delta phi dagger and a delta phi. We carry out the Bogoliubov transformation to diagonalize the quadratic terms in delta phi, which are also in there, which arise simply from the Bose condensate Hamiltonian, and end up with the Hamiltonian, which now has these linear terms still in there, and we get this h chi still, that's not changed, that's simply the optical lattice Hamiltonian, and then linear terms where these are the Bogoliubov excitations again, these are matrix elements describing the coupling of side nu to Bogoliubov excitation mu, some frequency of the Bogoliubov excitations, and since this is a density-density interaction, we get this n nu here as well. Plus, and here is just the energy of the Bogoliubov excitations. Now, how do we proceed with that? Well, what we do is a so-called Lang-Filsov transformation, which is a unitary transformation with an operator S that is given by these linear terms here, m nu mu, p mu minus the Hermitian conjugate times this n nu. And if we apply that transformation to the Hamiltonian, it turns into one that contains all the physics that I described before. So what we have here is we have some hopping term, where now this hopping term describes hopping of atoms in the lattice times some operator that creates the dip in the condensate. And this operator that creates the dip in the condensate happens to be a unitary Glauber displacement operator. That's exactly corresponding to the displacement of these Bogoliubov excitations that I discussed in the single particle case. So this simply creates a coherent cloud of phonons described by this operator. And this term here, therefore, corresponds to a compound of a particle in a lattice plus its surrounding phonon cloud. And that needs to move from side I to side J by carrying along this this phonon cloud. And that's exactly the Polaron operator. Yeah, that combined is the Polaron operator. Now, since these chi's, these x's here, are unitary operators, x I dagger x j would give 1. And therefore, these operators here, these nj's, or ni's that I have in there, can be interpreted either as just atoms or as polarons, so they don't change if I turn them into polaron operators. And so what we have here is a hopping term for the polarons, then we have some on-site interaction, which is now reduced by the polaron self-energy, this EP here, that reduces this on-site interaction. We also have a modified chemical potential, and then we get this offset interaction term, which describes interactions between nearby atoms via potential Vij. And this potential Vij is given by kappa squared over sigma g, so theta g, that's the Heeling length again. And then it has a exponential decay, which decays on the length scale of the Heeling length, so as expected. So if this A, the distance between the lattice sites, and the Xi are on the same order of magnitude, there will be some significant interaction between nearest neighbor atoms, but this interaction will decay exponentially, so it will decay quite quickly as one goes further away. So this part here of the Hamiltonian describes more or less nearest neighbor. If one tries very hard and makes this Xi larger, maybe next to nearest neighbor interactions as well. And then we have finally this operator here, which describes the energy of the Bogoliubov excitations.
So, nu is the chemical potential?
Yes.
I used to have a minus sign in front
of the operator. Okay, I can change that if you wish.
But the reason I'm asking is because if I do, then the UP cancel, the linear zero.
Yes, then I would have a plus here as well. So this EP that appears here is just to cancel this EP that appears in this NJ term here, in the NJ times minus 1. So I would have to change a few bits more. Yeah. Sorry about that.
Yeah,
Does the last term change the one with the BWP? Does that change when you apply the S?
No, that's already after I applied the S, so that stays. That term, I mean, that term appears again, but from that term we get a bit here.
Are you going to do more on this?
Yes. Why?
I should ask the question or just wait for you to cover it. Speaking as though you can think of this XA as a, just a some canonical goes on operating. But if you try and absorb the X into A, you generate some new operator that doesn't commute with B anymore.
Yeah, that's true. No, exactly. But X is not really a boson operator, it's a unitary operator, so X dagger X.
No, but still you can define a new
A
tilde, which is that combination.
Yeah, I could do that, yeah. Yeah. No, but I'm going to do a bit more with that. A little bit more.
Are there any issues yet about whether the effect of J after all this is zero?
Yeah, that's what I want to discuss next. So how does the presence of this term and the fact that this term does not commute with that one, how does that affect the hopping? Okay. Because what I've got so far is I found that the interaction, the onset interaction is reduced, that there is some offset interaction due to that tip, so that's what I said we expect before. But what I haven't gotten yet is that this hopping here is reduced to the presence of this term here. And that's what I will discuss next. And I will start out in the simplest possible case by assuming that this J over EP is very much less than 1. And so this term, the hopping term, is just a perturbation. The other terms are large. And that would be true if you go close to the Mott insulating case. And in this case, if that term is, if this is fulfilled, we can treat this hopping term just as a perturbation and integrate out all the Bogoliubov excitations. And what we then find is a standard extended Bose-Hubbard model with this term J replaced by a J tilde, and that J tilde is now describes the reduction in the hopping amplitude due to the presence of these phonons, to the effect that an atom has to carry along the phonons if it wants to move. And this J tilde is then simply given by this J times the expectation value of XI dagger XJ, and we can work that out in the case of a Bose condensate again and find this formula here where this NQ is the thermal occupation of the Bogoliubov modes. A is again the distance between the lattice sides. And so what we find here is that the hopping bandwidth, this J tilde, decreases exponentially with the temperature. There's an increase in temperature, these NQs go up, and increases exponentially with the kappa, which was absorbed here into this M.
How does the M depend on Q?
Well, the M are overlap matrix elements, which appear here. So this describes how the and the muth lattice side couples to the muth Bogoliubov excitation, so it's an overlap between them, and therefore depends on the Bogoliubov excitation. And in that case here, this calculation is done for a flat background gas, so the Bogoliubov excitations are labeled by Q.
No, I understand. I think what I'm kind of driving at is, does that have reciprocal powers of Q in it? What I'm worried about is whether that sum is finite or infinite.
Well, that
and if M naught of Q squared, for example, would not be infinite.
But this is finite. I do have the equations here. They are quite horrible, so I didn't put them up, but I can give them.
Because there might be some dimension dependent interesting thing working in there.
Yes. That's true, and we have only worked it out for certain cases. Okay, so that definitely is true. If the background BC is 1D, 2D, or 3D, this will change completely. Okay, so now this is the simplest case, and here are now finally some results where at very low temperatures. So if the temperature is a bit higher What we do then instead is we cannot simply eliminate these Bogoliubov of excitations anymore, but instead what we derive is a generalized master equation which projects out only the diagonal parts of the density matrix. So what I get there is an equation which describes the populations in a site I as a function of time and how that changes due to population in nearby sites. So what we find is that this population changes according to some integral with some kernel function or memory function wij and then population in nearby site, and it is decreased by some wji and then the population in the actual site. And we can work out, and we have worked out, these wijs of s keeping only nearest neighbor terms, so assuming that all correlations between nearest neighbors are important, but hopping directly from one site to further distant sites can be neglected. And in that case, what we find is for a three-dimensional background gas, and we have worked that out for other cases, that this memory function here at temperature T equals zero is quite similar to what we had before for these phase fluctuations. So it drops down a bit and then stays constant. And as we increase the temperature, it drops down further and then stays constant. And so at small temperatures, what we recover in that approach is a memory function which is more or less described by a step function, so it goes up from zero here to some finite value j tilde and then remains constant. So we can, in that case, for very small temperatures, replace this memory function by just the constant j, which is determined by this j tilde, and this equation will then describe wave-like motion of the particles or of the population consistent with the previous Hamiltonian that I had before. So this will just be coherent hopping. As we increase the temperature of the BEC, this drop of this memory function will be quicker, so will go further down. The hopping will be exponentially suppressed because of the larger temperature of the BEC, and after some intermediate region for temperatures larger than this polar on self-energy, what we get is a quick drop and then it goes basically to zero. So in that case, the Markov approximation is valid, and what we can do here is we can approximate this memory function by just the delta function times the area under that curve here. This area is not so easy to calculate, and we weren't able to really work that out yet, but it is, but still the Markov approximation here seems to be valid. So what we get then is at small temperatures this wave-like behavior, and at large temperature this diffusive behavior with some wij, which is hard to work out, and I'm not going to try to do that here. And as the temperature is increased, the behavior of the particles changes from wave-like to diffusive. And what we have done to study that is we have assumed that we now take just a single atom, put it into the BEC, and then let it expand throughout the lattice, and then work out how does it expand as a function of temperature. Now, if one does that, we see that the size of the density, L, grows like some linear term, A times T, plus some quadratic term, B times T squared, and we've worked out these A's and B's as a function of the temperature of the background gas. And what we find is, as expected, that at very low temperatures, A is zero, then increases. So this means that the diffusive behavior is almost not there at small temperatures, but then increases with increasing temperature, whereas the wave-like behavior described by this constant B here goes down as the temperature increases. And therefore, what we find is, consistent with this simple calculation that I did before, that at temperatures less than EP, we get wave-like behavior, we get coherent hopping, and as we increase the temperature, the hopping or the motion of the atoms through the lattice becomes diffusive. And we can change that continuously by simply changing the temperature of the BEC.
So I guess, I mean, this seems fairly reminiscent of what happens in ordinary polarons and condensed matter.
Yes.
If you have small polarons, you can go out and change temperature.
Yeah, that's. I think it. I mean, the techniques that I used here. I mean, we found them for exciton physics, where something similar happens, and that's, I think, in some bits of condensed matter, that that's fairly well known. Yes. Also, these long fields of transformation and that stuff is has been used in that context.
The point is that you can always engineer these things in other dimensions, where they may be, in fact, more pronounced effects than.
Yes, and we haven't worked out these things yet for all the dimensions, and but that's something that one could do. So we can't just assume that background BEC being a 1D BEC, being a 2D or 3D, and we can of course also change the lattice geometry. So we can make the lattice geometry 1D, 2D, 3D, and we can make the lattice asymmetric, and that's what I actually wanted to talk a bit about in the outlook.
Following on that question, so you're basically saying there's no difference between a fermionic boron and a bosonic boron in most of its properties.
As long as you don't look at the interaction terms and just look at a single polaron, yes, there is almost no difference.
Right. So, but presumably you can have two bosonic polarons sitting at the same site, whereas you can't.
Yes.
And that doesn't really affect the transport at all.
No, that does affect the transport, but that's true, and we have not investigated that yet. That's something we can do. Now, the key to that lies in this term here. The interaction, the on-site interaction, is reduced by the polaron self-energy, but there is still this repulsive interaction between the atoms in the lattice site. Now, this repulsive interaction can be changed by the depth of the lattice, and we can go into both regimes. We can go into the regime where this UA is much larger than the EP, and therefore double and higher occupations will be strongly suppressed. But we can also go into the regime where these two cancel more, cancel either exactly or more or approximately, and then what you say can happen. We have not looked at that yet, but certainly something that one can do here and check what happens in that situation. Now, we have looked at the opposite limit and checked what kind of clusters of polarons can be created there, since they have some nicer properties. And in particular, what we've been looking at is the case, again, low temperatures, so KBT less than EP, only a few nanokelvin, and then we assume that this U tilde, which is the U, the original repulsive interaction, minus the EP, is a lot larger than the other terms, so we can basically neglect double occupation in a lattice site. And then what one finds in that simple case is actually that the offset interactions lead to the formations of clusters, and this has been studied by Holstein already in 1959, and the model is very similar to this Holstein-Hubbard model. And we can work out what the binding energy of such clusters is. So if we get a cluster of S polarons sitting in adjacent lattice sites, then their binding energy will be S minus 1, and in the simplest approximation, just the offset interaction term. And they will have a lowest band, which has this binding energy in there, and then some bandwidth given by the J to the power of S, and this VJ, J plus 1 times 1 minus S again, and then such the cosinusoidal band. And the band of these clusters would look like that. The dots here are a full numerical calculation where we took the full potential and everything into account, and the red curve is this analytic approximation. So this works very well. And then we have considered the case where we have just three polarons sitting inside the lattice, and worked out what happens as we increase the temperature. And what we find there is that the formation of these clusters will happen at low temperatures. And the blue curve here is the probability of finding a cluster of three polarons sitting in adjacent lattice sites and moving together through the lattice. That goes down like this at temperatures on the order of EP again, or half an EP. And for the particular set of parameters that we've chosen here, the green line here would be the probability of finding a cluster of just two polarons sitting in adjacent lattice sites and one polaron being separated from that, moving through the lattice. Now, this type of system has the advantage, or this limit has the advantage, that we never get double occupation of these polarons, and as soon as we get some double occupation of the polarons, some inelastic processes might start to become dominant, and it might be that two lattice atoms together with a background atom just, you know, give some kind of molecule and fly away. In that case, everything is in adjacent lattice sites, and we only have to worry about two particle interactions. And so we think that these things are more stable, and they are more mobile, because as soon as you get two particles into one lattice site and study the hopping, their hopping or their transport is strongly suppressed, so they will not form that easily.
So does it stop at three, or does it keep on going?
It keeps on going, but
it's unstable if some of the uniform gas at the low end up.
Yeah, if you study a uniform gas at zero temperature,
yes,
that's what will happen. But but at small temperatures, and temperature will never be zero, the largest clusters will more easily break up than the smaller ones. So if the temperature is finite, there will be some size of cluster which is stable, and all the larger ones will not. Only at temperature zero that will happen. And already here, you see that these three, that this cluster of three polarons breaks up quite easily, and higher clusters with 100 or so polarons would, at temperatures of a nanokelvin or even below, already be broken.
I guess a little bit of a limit aspect of that, where you let the number of polarons diverge from the system size, because then what you might think is it's like two phases where you have a thing that's completely clustered, and then for a finite temperature, the entropy gets some boiled off into a gas. And
yes.
But if you take the limit of the latter side diverging from the full number of particles, then of course you, the entropy is bound to win, I guess, at any finite.
Yes, and we have not, you know, that's true, but there's also another reason we have not really studied that in very much detail, because it turns out that these binding energies for the larger clusters are sufficiently small, or they are sufficiently easily broken up, that in such experiments, at least at the moment, it is not possible to create a potential, background potential which is flat enough to support them. So if you don't have a really truly flat potential, they will break up just because of the inhomogeneities in the potential. So, well, in principle this might happen, but probably nobody's going to see any of that in the near future. Okay, so finally, this is my last slide. I would like to say a word on how to measure this. Now, how one can measure this is by measuring the fluctuations in the density-density correlations. And if one does that, so if one measures these Ni plus J correlations, and measurements similar to that have been discussed last week by Ian, I think, then what one sees is as these polarons form, these correlation functions become exponentially localized, so the density becomes localized exponentially as they form, and at the same time, the momentum distribution becomes broadened. So what one would see is that the momentum distribution gets broader, and the density-density correlations become localized. And I would like to add one more thing here, and this is that in general, from what I've shown today, I think one can conclude that the presence of a background gas does change the hopping parameters and the interaction parameters, but not necessarily in such a way that one can conclude that the onset of the Mott insulating phase happens earlier in the presence of a background gas. Because what happens is that while this coherent hopping certainly goes down, also the interaction, the repulsive interaction goes down, and at the same time some incoherent hopping starts to happen. So it is not enough to just measure the width of the momentum distribution, and by seeing a broader momentum distribution to conclude that now a Mott insulating phase has started to form, but one would also have to measure the particle fluctuations to really make that conclusion, because what could happen is that the hopping is just getting thermal, is just getting incoherent, therefore this thing broadens, but correspondingly the particle number fluctuations don't go down to conclude that this is a Mott insulating phase. So let me come to an outlook, brief outlook on that. Well, the first thing that we might want to do is now look at what happens if we make the whole thing anisotropic. So take hopping rates differently suppressed along different axes, make the the optical lattice asymmetric, that will make the offset interactions asymmetric, make the hopping, make the optical lattice asymmetric in its distance between lattice sites. All that will affect offset interactions and hopping rates in an asymmetric way, so that we can get different, different behavior along the different axes, and change the system from 3D to 2D to 1D, because that's fairly straightforward. And one thing that also might be of interest is to study what happens to fermions now in the presence of a background BC, which move in the first excited band, because there, of course, the wave functions are not necessarily symmetric anymore, and what we can get is very different types of interactions there. So, in other words, to play, as you said before, with the possibilities of changing the setup in many different ways and trying to, well, to engineer some bits that are more interesting. And the next thing that one can do is that corresponds more to the first bit of my talk. Probing the BEC by putting in these impurities can now be extended by putting in some entangled probes. So if I take two probes instead of one, first entangle them, put them into the BEC, then take them back and measure how their entanglement has changed. The question is, what does this tell me about the non-local properties of the BEC? And that's one thing that we can do. And then the next question is, what happens if we make these impurities very small compared to the scattering length? The scattering length in the BEC can be increased by making the by using, for instance, the Feshbach resonance. The size of the impurities is determined by the optical potential that can be made very small. So one can imagine making the size of the impurity just a few nanometers and increasing the scattering length to, well, 100 nanometers, such that the GP approach breaks down and that one can probe the properties of the condensate at the coordinate or at distances which are not well described by the Gospodarski approach that I showed today. And I talked in the beginning about the ability to do these things experimentally, and indeed Massimo Inguscio in Florence has set up an experiment with the Bose-Bose mixture already. He is just doing the state-dependent lattice that's under construction, and I will go there in May to see whether the whole thing that I discussed today really works. And well, if it does, I will be very happy. If it doesn't, we have to check what went wrong in our calculations. Thank you very much. Oh, and finally, the thing I forgot, it's at the very end. I would like to thank people involved in this. These are all the PhD students, postdoc, working in Oxford on these things.
So the part of the calculation which you said is low temperature, what's the region of the validity for that calculation in the following sense? The formulas are acting in some sense like a dissipation for some Hubbard model, right? So,
but they don't dissipate energy. So the only thing they can do, I mean, at least in this first order that I talked about today, is they can, because of the band. So they cannot change the quasi-momentum. Basically, if you look at it in a quasi-momentum picture, they cannot take a particle from a high quasi-momentum to a low one, but all they do is they deface it. And that's also what you see if a particle, I mean, if a polaron moves from one lattice site to the next, then this movement is achieved only by changing the phases of the Bogoliubov excitations. You don't need to change any population of the Bogoliubov excitations. They move by just changing the relative phases of them.
If the atoms in the lattice are actually in the end in the superfluid part of the phase diagram, it seems like outside the
end. Yes, I mean that's the limit which I haven't really talked about, because would I...
On the localized side of the diagram for the...
Yes.
The atoms in the lattice.
Yeah, that's what we did. I mean, I always have made the assumption that this J is small, and in the first part of the calculation, I just treat it as a perturbation to the other terms in the second part of the calculation, this generalized master equation is also only valid if that term is reasonably small. If this is the dominant term, then it wouldn't work. I mean, these calculations really not work. But J is usually, I mean, you know, can be made the small term, and that's the interesting region. I mean, in the other region, when J is very large, then what we have is just a mixture of two BECs. I can write down two Gross-Peterewski equations and solve those.
So it's definitely in the Hawking regime.
Yes, yeah. And the other limit, I mean, that would be just a mixture of two BECs, one in a Gross-Peterewski equation with a biotic potential and the other one maybe in a trap.
But, I mean, in principle, it could also affect the transition, change the nature of the transition of the four cells in the balance.
Yes, but only at large interactions.
In the Kuhn scheme, I understood that you could remove particles from elements and leave them in the world and the limit.
Yes.
But those particles are still coupled to the condensate and thermalized with that.
Yeah.
And that condensate has been heated by the emission of energy from that.
Well, it's again the same reason. The particles in the lower, well, let me see. The particles in the lowest band will always be a situation, unless it work, a situation where the Bloch band, the lowest Bloch band, is a lot flatter than the phonon spectrum here. So if I have particles sitting down there, all that happens is that they start to deface.
But they can't absorb a phonon, but they can scatter one.
They can scatter one, and the scattering of the phonon will change their phase, but it will not change their quasi-momentum. So,
change their energy?
No.
Well, I can take
it. Yeah, at very large temperatures, yes, that can happen. But, there's several other things that I haven't talked about. What happens in this case, when, how is the Bose condensate heated due to the cooling? The phonons which are emitted, I mean, these only phonons in a kind of quotation mark, because these particles will have energies on the order of tens or hundreds of kilohertz. And these energies are a lot larger than the trap depth usually are. So what happens to them is that they will be ejected out of the experiment and never return. So they don't heat the condensate in that sense, they just remove a particle from the condensate and then go away. And the probability that they interact with another atom in there is fairly small. I mean, in standard Bose condensate, if you do evaporative cooling, I think on average a particle moves 15 times in the trap before it interacts. And this one just needs to move once through the cloud and then will be gone. So the heating is negligible.
I guess even if you have non-interacting fermions, in principle, various things could happen. For example, if they were half filled, then your condensate could act as a kind of medium for a pass transition. So you could decide to set up a periodic thing with twice the period in the condensate to gap the fermions, which in 1D probably always works.
Yes, maybe.
But then there are issues about how the whole thing dephases and one for the fluctuation reasons. But that, again, make a very clean place to look at that sort of thing.
Yes.
It's quite hard to do with the impurities and in the swimming system.
I mean, actually, we've been trying to do, one of the ideas that we had was to actually use a one-dimensional condensate and put quantum dots in there and use them as qubits, because they have very nice properties. You can move them around and they will change their phase, and you can do phase gates and all kinds of stuff with those if they are placed into a 1D condensate. And that would in principle be very nice. The thing is that they will dephase quite quickly. And so we can't really use them as qubits. That one of the reasons we did this calculation was to see whether such an impurity placed into a 1D condensate is a good qubit. But from that calculation, it turns out not. But still, it might be interesting from different perspectives. Unfortunately, not for qubits.
No more questions. Let's end this.